4 this morning to drive here from Michigan. So we're going to try a little bit of an experiment to see how much of a talk I can get through that's powered entirely by cappuccino. So I want to talk about some crust microphysics and maybe come down to the bottom. Concept I'd like to emphasize, the astrophysicists work on benchmarking their codes. I think it's really important to benchmark the microphysics. So we should think of ways to try and do that. I'm going to give a little bit of a colloquium. It's going to be very elementary to try to motivate thinking about solid stars. Before I get going, I do want to mention one experiment. This lead radius experiment is a way to try to infer from a laboratory experiment on a nucleus some information about the equation of state of neutron matter. So PRAX uses parity violet electron scattering to accurately measure the neutron radius of lead, and that's going to have a bunch of implications for nuclear structure, astrophysics, atomic parity violation, and low energy tests of the standard model. So I'll just briefly mention the equation of state in astrophysics. We want to look in a nucleus in a model-independent way where the neutrons are, and it turns out parity violation is a trick that allows us to do that. So in the standard model, the carrier of the weak neutral force, the Z boson, couples to the weak charge. The weak charge of a proton is very small. The weak charge of a neutron is big. So at low momentum transfers, the weak interactions probe the neutrons. And what the experiment actually measures is this parity-violating asymmetry. Cross-section difference for positive helicity electrons scattering from a lead nucleus minus the cross-section for negative helicity electrons. So it's a weak interaction. This is order of part per million. And the parity-violating asymmetry allows you to measure the weak form factor. Basically, it's the Fourier transform of the weak charge density. So what's measured is basically the weak charge density at one low momentum transfer. So it's a scattering of 1 g of the electrons at 5 degrees. And we just announced our first results. The measured parity-violating asymmetry, 0.657 parts per million, very good systematic errors. Unfortunately, we didn't get the statistics we hoped. Nevertheless, it's a measurement of a part per million asymmetry to better than 10%. So this is the Fourier transform of the neutron density at low momentum transfers, gives us the neutron radius. And in particular, in lead, the neutrons, so this is a model where the dashed is the neutron density. The proton density is there. Lead has 82 protons, 126 neutrons. And the neutrons stick out. There's this neutron-rich skin. The neutron radius, RMS radius, minus the known proton RMS radius, 0.34 Fermi's, so that's the thickness of the skin, with a relatively large error, plus 0.15 minus 0.17. Okay, so the plan, we'd very much like to run again to get more statistics, reduce this error bar by a factor of 3. We'd also like to do a second measurement on calcium 48. Uh-huh. I'll say yes. the Coulomb distortions are a big correction, about 25% correction. So that's multiple photon exchange. And you could say this is the first observation of Coulomb distortion for parity violation. The gamma Z box diagram that we predict to be big for the proton experiment Q weak, we predict is pretty small here. Actually, this number is just the experimental systematic errors. So the assumption is that the theoretical systematic errors, well, are small compared to, I would say, plus or minus 0.02, the original goal. Okay. One way to think about this neutron skin is it's neutron-rich matter. The pressure of neutron-rich matter forces the neutrons out against surface tension. So if you have a big pressure, that gives a big skin, a big neutron radius. So Alex Brown showed there was a strong correlation between the pressure of neutron matter and the neutron skin. And so what's plotted here is the pressure of neutron matter as a function of density. And this is plotted 10 to the 33 dynes per square centimeter to make the astrophysicist happy. At some subnuclear density, some average of the surface and interior density in lead, say two-thirds of normal density, if the pressure, for example, was 1/10 to the 33, Alex Brown would say that corresponds to a neutron skin of about 0.15 Fermis, and so on. So there's the measured PREC skin. 0.34 is a relatively big pressure, but the error bars are still large. So if we can reduce the error bars, this corresponds to measuring the pressure of neutron matter at slightly subnuclear density. And so the curves here are theoretical calculations of Hebler et al. And there's an important contribution from three neutron forces to the calculation of the pressure of neutron matter. Okay. So I want to talk about solid microphysics. There's lots of microphysics that you're interested in. Shear modulus, breaking strain, bulk modulus, shear viscosity, thermal conductivity, electrical conductivity, diffusion, and so on. I won't talk about all those. Let's back up. Solid stars. That's a little weird. I believe you should ask more questions, more basic questions, like how do stars freeze? Well, stars are plasmas. But the plasma can be so dense, for example, in the interior of a white dwarf, that they freeze. So the neutron star crust is a plasma crystal. Plasma crystals were first observed in the laboratory in 1994. In stars, the plasma consists of ions plus very degenerate relativistic electrons. So the interaction between two ions is just Coulomb that's been slightly screened by the electrons. So the electrons give a relatively large Thomas Fermi screening length. You can make a complex plasma in the laboratory where there's micron-sized microparticles. The microparticles in a weakly ionizing gas acquire very large negative charges, 3,000 or so. And then the strong Coulomb interactions between the microparticles can cause them to crystallize. So the laboratory plasmas typically have a shorter screening length, which gives a different kind of lattice than the body-centered cubic we expect in stars. But then you also have fluctuating and friction interactions of the microparticles with the background gas. Okay, so here's a picture of a laboratory plasma crystal. And this is not a computer simulation. This is actually observed coordinates. So this experiment was done in microgravity on the space station. There's a laser scanner which recorded the X, Y, and Z positions of each of about 10 to the fourth particles. And they changed the conditions. You start out with an amorphous mess. It actually crystallizes. And the different colors, the red and orange, if you can see it, correspond to a nice crystalline order, and the green and blue is an amorphous mess for the particles. So you can actually watch a plasma crystal freeze and then melt. white dwarfs. When a white dwarf freezes, it releases latent heat, and that slows the cooling. So this is the observed luminosity function. So it's just number of white dwarfs of different luminosities for one field in globular cluster NGC 6397. If you form white dwarfs at some constant rate, you'll see a lot of white dwarfs at luminosities where they're cooling very slowly. So Winget et al. Claim that this peak in the luminosity function is due to the release of latent heat. So at this luminosity, the white dwarfs are freezing, and so they spend a lot of time sitting there radiating away the latent heat. Okay, I want to talk about neutron star crust, and I decided to take a position, so I'll make a hypothesis. Neutron star crust is an extremely good crystal that's remarkably free of defects, such as vacancies, dislocations, and grain boundaries. Okay? And I'll say a neutron star crust is a nearly perfect solid. And, of course, I say this so we can spend lots of time arguing about what a nearly perfect solid is. But maybe we can do that later. Diffusion in these systems is very fast. That's why I think they're remarkably perfect. The ions in a star are completely pressure ionized. They have a 1 over R Coulomb interactions, but there are no hard cores. I say that to condensed matter people. They smile nicely, and then they ignore me and say, of course they're hard cores. There's always hard cores. Nope, no hard cores. So diffusion may be much faster than in conventional materials because the ions can get by one another. They don't bump up into any hard cores. As an example, we've run a simulation. This is 27,000 ions. We take a liquid at the melting temperature and then instantaneously quench the temperature by a large amount, by a factor of 3. So we rescale the velocities so that suddenly the temperature is 3 times lower than the melting temperature. So the system is amorphous. It looks like a frozen liquid, at least temporarily. And then we evolve this amorphous mass for a long time. If we evolve it for a whole bunch of time, it starts forming microcrystals. And if you can see, there's little microcrystal patterns in here. And then if you keep evolving longer, one of these microcrystals takes over, and the system spontaneously, a very short period of time, transforms to here to here. The total simulation was about 10 million over the plasma frequency. This time is, shucks, 1,000 inverse plasma. Okay. So, system spontaneously crystallized. So this fast diffusion suggests that white dwarf interiors and neutron star crust are remarkably perfect crystals that are free from defects. Okay, that, of course, is theory. Are there any observations? Let me give you one that's at least related. So this is a neutron star which accreted for about a decade, and then the accretion stopped. When it was accreting, that heated the crust. And then you can watch the crust cool, and time zero is when the accretion was observed to stop. And so the red points are the experimental data, which have had error bars arbitrarily blown up by bad theorists, but never mind. And the crust cools relatively quickly. If it was amorphous, it would have a low thermal conductivity, and it would cool very slowly. So this amorphous crust cooling time is much longer than observed. So the data favors a high thermal conductivity and a crystalline crust for the neutron star. Okay, if you have nice crystalline rocks, one thing you can do is build mountains. And so I'd like to talk just very briefly about gravitational waves from mountains on neutron stars. So if you want a continuous gravitational wave source, that places extraordinary demands on the neutron-rich matter. You want, let's see, you want it as strong as possible, so we want sort of macroscopic microphysics. You want it as big as possible. How do you generate gravitational waves? It sounds easy. You place a mass on a stick and you shake vigorously. You may need both a large mass and a strong stick. So let me talk here about the strong stick. For example, consider a large mountain, this red thing over here, which is not to scale. That should be a couple millimeters high. So we have a large mountain on a rapidly rotating neutron star. That's a time-dependent quadrupole moment. It radiates gravitational waves. The fundamental question, might not come to it immediately, is how do you hold the mountain up? Okay? You can also get continuous gravitational waves from R modes, and the R modes depend on damping, shear and bulk viscosity and so on. Unfortunately, I won't talk about R modes here. Uh-huh. Yes. It's a full millimeter high. How can you call that a defect? I should say it's kilometer wide and a millimeter high, a few millimeters high. If you want to call it a defect, it may have the mass of the moon. Okay. So how big can the quadrupole moment be? Depends on the strength of the crust before it collapses under the extreme gravity of a neutron star. So we've performed molecular dynamic simulations of crust breaking, where we include the effects of variety of different kinds of defects, impurities, grain boundaries, and so on. And let me just show you quickly this movie. So what we've done is we're moving a frozen layer on the top to one side. It stresses the system. The red color is the deformation of the crystal. So let me try that again. We had a defect in the center to begin with. We pre-drilled a hole, and it starts deforming around there. But there's big pressure. The system doesn't fail until you've bodily deformed large regions of the crust. And as a result, the system is very strong. If you want a number, it's 10 billion times stronger than steel. This high strength is very promising for gravitational wave searches. Okay, so let me just elaborate on what I'm claiming and then talk about the gravitational wave searches. So the breaking strain, so this is the fractional deformation of the lattice. We say that the breaking strain is large, of order 0.1. You can deform the crystal lattice by about 10% before it breaks. So that's a really big strain. Often conventional materials fail at much smaller strains, and they fail because when you strain the system, that causes defects to migrate, and then a bunch of defects collect and weaken the system at one particular spot, and then it fractures. It breaks, and you open up a void at that point. Okay, plasma crystals are different. There's a large pressure that suppresses the formation of vacancies. So you never open up a void. You never get a fracture. You suppress the number of vacancies. Any other defects which were there originally, we believe, diffuse rapidly away so that the crystal is remarkably perfect to begin with. The very few remaining defects don't impact the strength very much. They have a very small impact on the strength. And the reason is the long-range Coulomb interactions. Each ion has long-range Coulomb interactions with thousands of its neighbors. Think of an ion bonding with thousands of its neighbors. If a few of the neighbors are out of place, it doesn't matter very much. So these many redundant bonds give the great strength of the material. Okay, do we have any evidence that, in fact, the crust is very strong? Maybe. Let me give you an argument. The argument assumes the crust-breaking mechanism, and now I'm talking about magnetar giant flares. So this mechanism, due to Thompson and Duncan, says that a magnetar giant flare involves a huge earthquake, a huge breaking of the neutron star crust. So a huge magnetar field stresses the crust finally breaks, allows the field to reconnect, and then you release lots of magnetic energy. So we find that the crust is very strong and can control large energies in the magnetic field. So within this model, you could say, for example, the 2004 flare from SGR-1806 had this extraordinary 10 to the 46 erg energy. So this very large energy within that crust-breaking model is evidence that the crust, in fact, is very strong. If the crust were weaker, you would likely not control as much magnetic energy before the system broke. Okay. Mountains are very strong. You can have relatively big ones, and that's exciting for gravitational wave searches from mountains. One comment is the searches are very computationally intensive. You can sign up your home computer, and they will happily use it to search. What kind of neutron stars are interesting to look for gravitational waves? If I could just very briefly, and the experts can correct me, you could look for fast-rotating stars. The gravitational wave power rapidly increases with frequency. You could look for stars which are accreting lots of material. An argument Lars Bilstein and others have made is that the fastest neutron stars only spin at about half the breakup rate. So maybe it's because the angular momentum that you gain from accretion is being radiated away in gravitational waves. If that's what's going on, a star with large accretion could have a large gravitational wave luminosity. And so one candidate, for example, is Cygnus 6-1. You could also look, for young and radio-bright stars such as the Crab. And indeed, their searches on the Crab have now, of course, we haven't discovered any gravitational waves, but there's an upper limit. Of course, we believe the Crab is slowing down because it's radiating electromagnetic waves. The gravitational wave limit is such that only a few percent of the observed rotational power, a few percent or less, of course, it's an upper limit, is in gravitational waves. So we now know observationally that the Crab is not slowing down primarily in gravitational waves. You're looking at the universe in a whole new way. The vast majority of neutron stars are unknown, and so there's lots of exciting, unknown, and unexpected things to look for. Okay. Lots of things I'm not talking about. So let me just end with a couple things that I'm not talking about. I didn't say anything about pasta. There's lots of interesting questions there. My favorite is the bottom. How do you smell the pasta? What observables are sensitive to the pasta? How do you observationally demonstrate that pasta is really there? That's hard. Let me just emphasize. My collaborators had a number of good students and former students working with me, Joe Huto and Gang Shen are here, and I thank you very much for your attention. Or cappuccino.
questions?
So if I remember your 0.1 breaking strain paper, you say that plastic deformation doesn't occur until immediately before the fracturing. But I'm a little bit worried that the shear rates that you're applying it at are, in fact, sort of enormous. Uh-huh. Like, you know, you're punching the star at the speed of light. And, you know, anything's going to shatter if you punch it at the speed of light.
I mean, these are the questions you always ask. The molecular dynamic simulation, I showed you one and only had 2 million ions. The biggest simulation we've done is about 13 million. And, of course, the times we run for is short compared to the year timescale for a star. So you always have to do some extrapolations. My arguments that the extrapolations, well, first of all, we've looked at the strength as a function of shear rate, at least for the rates we can do, and we don't see very little time dependence. And we've also looked at the function of size, and we see very little size dependence for the sizes we can do. But my arguments are really two. The first is diffusion is fast, so there should be very few defects to start with. And then we put in defects. We put in impurities, we put in grain boundaries, and they do very, very little. So because of these long-range Coulomb interactions, if the defects are there, they don't affect the strength very much. Okay.
Right, a couple of related questions. On what timescales should one take into account plastic flow as well as elasticity, and also once the crust has broken in a quake, for example, how quickly does it heal?
Yeah. So with a Russian collaborator, Andrei Truganov, we've been trying to fit some semi-phenomenological models to our molecular dynamics simulations and then extrapolate the models to much larger timescales. So what we find in these models is that crusts are not expected to flow very much over, say, a year timescale until the temperature is pretty close to the melting temperature. But again, it's a semi-phenomenological model, so it's indirect. It's a very hard thing to get it directly.
Sorry, my second question was, how quickly does it heal once it's broken?
Ah, yes. It breaks very quickly. There's some speed of the failure wave, which is high. And then the crystal recovers very quickly. And so in a simulation, we can actually show, I don't know if there's chalk. Maybe I can just draw it with a laser pointer. So the stress is rising with strain. It goes up. It breaks. It recovers, and then it goes up again. So I think the crystal reforms pretty quickly. So these are within the simulation time scale. So that's very, very short.
So what is that, simulation time scale?
Thousands to tens of thousands of plasma oscillation periods.
That's much, much under, you know, fractions of a millisecond?
Yes. Yeah. So. Yes. Molecular dynamics time scales, 10 to the minus 20 seconds.
Okay, so I do binary simulations and don't know anything about this, so this may be a dumb question. But so we ignore any effects of solid crusts in our in-spirals and mergers. Can this have a significant influence on how neutron stars respond to tidal deformation or to tidal forces?
I would say yes.
Because
let me throw out a question to the audience. When and how does the crust break during in-spiral? When you have a crust, I think it impacts this Love number and the shape, the tidal deformation of a neutron star.
Oh, okay. Maybe I could hand this over to you.
Not really. So I had a question about the Tipple, this Tipple-Brown correlation you... Oh, okay.
Well, what is on? So far we find that it only affects it with one part in 10 to the 4, like for our preliminary studies. It's proportional to the pressure, just like the Hensel model.
So point, you're saying it impacts the Love number, or...?
The Love number is affected one part in 10 to the 4. The shear modulus is 1.5 10 to the minus 2 times the pressure in the crustal region.
Okay, so I had a question about the Tipple-Brown correlation. You showed this, the picture of the Prex result and the comparison to the Hiebler-Brown, or the Hiebler-Schwenk neutron matter results. I'm not sure if that Tipple-Brown correlation was actually a relation between the neutron skin thickness and the derivative of the neutron matter energy or the derivative of the symmetry energy.
It was the... In fact, what his x-axis was, at least as far as I understand it, is the derivative of the neutron matter energy with respect to density. So it's actually the pressure over the density squared.
Right,
like
right.
That.
Okay. But there is a confusion sometimes between this, how the symmetry energy is defined. So.
We should only have a couple more comments, probably.
One question. If you've got a superfluid neutron interpenetrating the crust, could you say how much effect that has on your results, even in a hand wavy sense?
I don't have a clue. My first guess is the shear modulus is the Coulomb interaction. So superfluid neutrons shouldn't affect that very much. So at least my hope is that the shear modulus and the breaking strain of crust is not affected very much. The breaking strain of pasta is completely up in the air. Where the question becomes more interesting is the shear speed for shear modes, because there you need a mass. And so when the crust oscillates, do the superfluid neutrons go with the crystal lattice or not? So that's its entrainment coefficients. And my understanding is the calculations give pretty big entrainment coefficients, so that most of the superfluid actually moves with the shear oscillations. But that's not work that I've done.
I guess it's probably time to move to the next speaker, so we can go set that up, Eric.